Hi, I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk.
On today's show, we'll talk with our health blogger, Scott Hensley, about angry pedestrians, copycat drugs, and how calorie counts aren't scaring Americans away from fast food.
Later, we'll hear the story of children born with an addiction to painkillers.
And we'll learn why some Northern California cheesemakers are in trouble with the FDA.
But first, we'll hear about a problem a lot of parents deal with, teaching their kids self-control.
Mm-hmm. And getting them to eat something other than mac and cheese.
The good news is, both are possible.
Reporter Sarah Varney of member station KQED in San Francisco recently caught herself pleading with her toddler to eat just one pea. That's when she decided to find out if there's a better way to deal with picky eaters.
Bedtime reading seems an excellent opportunity for toddler mind control. I've recently slipped one book into heavy rotation, and in it, I've placed my highest parental aspirations.
How does a dinosaur eat all his food? Does he spit out his broccoli, partially chewed?
Nope.
It's called How Do Dinosaurs Eat Their Food? And for frustrated parents, it's a full-on food fantasy.
He tries every new thing, at least one small bite.
And, of course, it's nothing like dinner with my son, Fountain.
I only want mac and cheese, not peas.
Do you want to grow up to be a big boy, or do you want to be a little tiny boy your whole life?
When you find yourself taunting your three-year-old, stoking fears of dwarfism, it's perhaps time to call for help.
Hello, this is Ellen.
If you're in preschool purgatory with pint-sized persnicketers, you want Ellen Satter on speed dial. Author of two popular books on parent-child feeding relationships, patron saint of child development researchers, I read her some of the strategies I collected from parents of picky toddlers, using toothpicks to create green bean spaceships, awarding stickers, and playing a guessing game of which chicken finger they'll eat next.
Those parents are working way too hard. And the rule of thumb is the harder you work to try to get food into your child, the less likely your child will eat.
Ellen's idea is this. Our job as parents is to put healthy food on the table. And the kids decide whether to eat and how much, without promises of popsicles or threats to call Santa Claus, which I'm still doing even though it's February. Eventually, she says, perhaps the 10th or 20th or 30th time they try a new food, toddlers will start to like it.
Even if he only eats bread, even if he eats 5 slices of bread and drinks milk, whatever he wants to eat, he can eat.
This sounded like heresy. I grew up under strict orders to clean my plate or else. Surely my son Fountain would starve if left to his own devices.
Young children are very good at regulating their intake so that they're getting the proper amount of calories and fat and carbohydrate and protein for growth, as long as they're offered a healthy range of items.
Andrea Garber is the chief childhood nutritionist at the University of California, San Francisco. She says the scientific research backs up the softer approach. In labs set up to look like preschools, kids who were offered a high-calorie first course chose, on their own, a lower-calorie second course. And those offered a low-calorie first course, they opted for a second course with higher calories. In other words, they self-regulated. But Garber says this built-in appetite control can go haywire when parents interfere. In another experiment, kids were given a meal followed by a snack free-for-all.
What they found is that kids who had mothers who were more restrictive, when the mother wasn't present or wasn't putting restrictions on and the kid was exposed to snack foods like cookies, for example, that child ate significantly more cookies when the control was not applied.
Even still, the idea of sitting idly by and trusting a child to eat right can be terrifying.
Yoda said there's doing or not doing. There is no trying.
Back on my call with Ellen Satter, I make the mistake of telling her I'll give her method a try.
If you're good about regular meals, regular snacks, variety of food, and no pressure, I would suggest to you after 3 or 4 months, you're going to see evidence of his sneaking up on unfamiliar food and learning to like it.
I fear it might take a little longer.
I don't like broccoli.
What about cauliflower?
I don't like flour.
For NPR News, I'm Sarah Varney.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Learning to eat broccoli before dessert is one way children learn self-control, which is an important skill.
A new study says that self-control in childhood seems to make a difference between getting a good job or going to jail. And we can learn it back in preschool. NPR's Nancy Shute reports.
Four-year-olds aren't known for their self-control. But when you walk into this classroom at the Clara Barton Children's Center in Cabin John, Maryland, you'll hear 16 very young children very busy playing, and you won't hear hitting or whining or yelling. They've got it under control.
By accident I did it.
Social scientists say three things matter for success in life: IQ, family socioeconomic status, and self-control. Only one of those things is easy to change, and it's self-control. A child who has self-control at age 4 is more likely to be happy and healthy as an adult. That's what Terry Moffitt says. She's a professor of psychology at Duke University. She studied a group of 1,000 young people since birth.
Children who had the greatest self-control in primary school and preschool ages were most likely to have fewer health problems and least likely to be addicted to any kind of a substance when they reached their 30s.
But the children who struggled with self-control had problems as young adults.
We found that they were more likely to have a criminal conviction record.
They were also more likely to be poor or to be single parents.
And finally, we found that the children with low self-control had great difficulty in their 30s with financial planning.
That means they were more likely to be in debt, have bad credit, or have declared bankruptcy. Moffitt's study, which was published in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, is the best evidence yet on the payoff for learning self-discipline early on, and it can be taught.
Identical twins are not identical on self-control, and that tells us that it is something that they have learned, not something that they have inherited.
Teaching self-control has become a big focus for early childhood education. At the Clara Barton Preschool, it starts with expecting a 4-year-old to hang up her coat. Linda Owen is the center's director.
The very fact that they have to put away their lunches, hang up their own clothes, then choose where they're going to play, all those things help with self-management.
Of course, not all 4-year-olds can manage that, but this classroom has been set up to help them manage themselves. There are all sorts of cues and clues to help them make independent decisions.
The first step.
When Eden Aronoff washes her hands, she sees 7 pictures that show her just what to do.
Soap on your hands, turn on the water, scrub.
When the children disagree, they can turn to the solution kit. It's a poster that shows them 10 different ways to end the argument. Rowan Miller and Miles Gordon name a few.
Being fair.
Yeah.
Sharing's
a good one.
Play together.
And when things do go wrong, there are consequences. Linda Owen points to a group of children building a huge tower of blocks.
If one of our children, who we know has impulse control problems, came by and kicked that over right now, the consequence would be they would need to come back and help rebuild it.
Sure enough, those blocks get bumped over, and with a little prompting, the children work together to rebuild it.
RJ, how do you want me to build it?
Parents also can help their children learn self-control. Mary Alvord is a clinical psychologist in Silver Spring, Maryland. She says, start with one simple thing.
Learn delay of gratification, which means simply that you don't get what you want immediately, and you may have to wait a little while.
Teenagers can learn better self-control, too.
You can't have any screen time until your homework is done.
But researcher Terry Moffitt says the earlier children can learn these skills of self-discipline and perseverance, the better.
The later you wait in life to try to learn self-control skills, the more problems you have to reverse and overcome.
All the more reason to start picking up blocks when you're very young. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
When I was a little boy,
Brave, I was just a boy.
The devil called my name,
Brave, I was just a boy.
I say now, who do you think you're fooling?
So this is my favorite part of every week, which is when we get to check in with our diligent and healthy health blogger, Scott Hensley. Hi.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Rebecca. Hi, April.
So, Scott, I saw a post on the blog this week that has gotten us all talking and looking, doing some deep introspective searching about our own behavior. It's all about aggressive walking.
Road rage is not just for drivers. Those of us, I think we all cop to it when we were discussing this post. We're a bunch of aggressive walkers here, and there was a great story in the Wall Street Journal written by a former colleague of mine who happens to be a clinical psychologist.
Uh-oh.
About this this syndrome or phenomenon. And some
sidewalk
of the people,
rage,
yeah,
right?
Sidewalk rage, and some of the people who research it, including a guy at the University of Hawaii. I didn't think it was possible to be enraged by anything while you were living in Hawaii, but his wife diagnosed him when he was confronting the hordes of tourists on the sidewalk.
Well,
there.
Yeah. Okay, but that's perfectly justified.
I suppose.
Tourists, we all know tourists yes. go
tourists
really
in Washington,
slow.
D.C. are a main reason why some of us might have sidewalk rage.
But we love them anyway.
Yes, we do. We'll take their money.
In the post, I linked to a site that this guy has. Dr. Driving is part of the URL. He does some stuff on road rage as well. And I printed it out, and maybe we could ask each other a few questions here. There's a 15-question pedestrian aggressiveness syndrome scale, or PASS.
Do you feel enraged at other pedestrians and enjoy thoughts of violence from time to time walking around the pedestrians?
Less so since I moved to Washington. How's that for an answer?
Why is that? Just less people? Or
I think it's a little less crowded here.
Have you been by the Woodley Park Zoo on a Saturday afternoon with double-wide strollers on the sidewalk?
I haven't done that.
And all those tourists.
Sounds like I should avoid that. Let me ask you. I think I know the answer to this one. But April, do you find yourself walking much faster than the rest of the people on the sidewalk?
Absolutely. And muttering at other pedestrians. I have to plead guilty to that one,
too. That's question number seven, the muttering. Now, Rebecca, what about you? Did you see anything familiar here for you?
Okay, number six. Walking on the left of a crowded passageway where most pedestrians walk on the right.
That sets you off.
I always do that, and it might be followed up by number eight, which is bumping into others.
Well, I thought that the Wall Street Journal article was fascinating, and I tried to pick some of the highlights and also link to some things like this questionnaire for people who are interested.
Yeah.
Is it a real syndrome?
Well, I don't think it's in the DSM, that guide, yet, but
we'll have to get Elise in here.
Yeah, we'll have to get Elise Spiegel to search on that a little bit more.
Well, another thing that you wrote up on the blog that was really cool, and it was more about the picture, was this old picture from the 40s or 50s. What was that about?
Oh, yeah, that was great.
You know, sometimes procrastination pays off in the blogging business, I found. And I was looking through some pictures in an archive from the National Museum of Health and Medicine here in Washington. And there was some...
We should do the podcast live from there sometime. Or maybe not live. Podcast and live don't go together. Yeah. But that would be fun.
But it was pretty cool. They had all kinds of stuff. It's mostly military things. And they had some terrific posters, health-related posters from World War II. And there was one that I thought was kind of cool enough that I put it up on the blog. And it says, "Don't bite off more than you can chew. Take only what you can eat."
What does it look like?
Well, it's a sailor who's got a bone sort of Flintstone style sticking out of his mouth, and he's turning red, and
he's pretty fleshy, cheeks, right?
Exactly. And this poster, I think, was not really about health. It was more about don't waste scarce food during wartime.
Right.
But the message seemed so resonant with all the problems that so many of us have about eating too much.
That's true.
On that one, and yeah. I sort of thought, hey, this is kind of cool, so I put it up there, and I'm going to try and do some more visual things on the blog. We've had this redesign recently, which I talked about in a previous podcast, and this is something that we couldn't show off as well in the past, so it's up there, and we'll see what people think.
So this kind of relates somewhat, April, to a post you did recently about Americans and fast food choices.
That's right, Rebecca. So I did a piece for the blog about this very limited study of racial and ethnic minorities who frequent fast food places like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and I think KFC as well, Kentucky Fried Chicken. So basically what it did was look at people in New York City before the labeling law requirements went into effect that said you have to post how many calories are in the food, and then afterwards with a similar group of people. And what they found was that knowing the calorie counts really didn't seem to matter for their food choices.
And I was wondering if I'd been in that situation, what I would have done. Like, would I have actually turned away from an enormous, like, what are some of the calorie counts we're talking about?
that are being posted in fast food these days, but like maybe 1,000 calories.
Yeah. Wouldn't be uncommon. Yeah.
Right. For like a double cheeseburger would be thousands of calories.
Exactly.
We're talking about a lot. And that's a huge percentage of the number of calories people are supposed to take in a day, which is another issue. A lot of people don't really know how to count calories or how much calories they should be ingesting. So as the study author told me, this is just the tip of the iceberg here. You know, just listing the calories needs to go along with some other things on education. Mm-hmm. It's hard to compete with Ronald McDonald.
Right. So just putting a number out there doesn't necessarily mean anything
right.
to people.
Right. Now, there's a national effort underway that was part of the healthcare law to label fast food restaurant menus and other chain restaurant menus so that what New York's doing is going to be nationwide at some point. So this study was just sort of pointing out that there's a long way to go to educate people mm-hmm. about this.
Well, I will tell you, one time I did walk into a restaurant, and it was a sandwich shop, and I think it's kind of a normal, you know, not a super fast food place, kind of your medium lunch sandwich place. And I bought a sandwich, and I noticed it had like 650 calories. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that seems like a lot for a sandwich, but I did eat it anyway. And then my solution was just to feel guilty about it for the rest of the day.
Well, this study didn't measure anybody's guilt motivations, but, you know, maybe that's the next step.
Maybe it is. It's a terrible motivator.
Something totally unrelated that there's no possible link to that I can start with here is two things that a lot of men care about: balding and prostate cancer. What was that about?
Richard Knox did a terrific post for us looking at this French study of nearly 700 men. And the upshot of it was, if these guys started to lose their hair in their 20s, they were twice as likely to develop prostate cancer later on in life.
I think that is very interesting.
My poor husband.
Really?
One thing worth pointing out here is this was not correlated with men getting a more or less aggressive form of the disease. Mm-hmm. It was just the overall. So mm-hmm. it's nothing to, you know, completely freak out about, mm-hmm. but it was quite provocative, and it might be a clue as to which men would benefit the most from more careful screening
right.
and regular screening, uh-huh. which is a real controversy, when to do a prostate type of PSA test and when not to. And so I think it was provocative.
Now, why do they think there's a link between losing your hair and developing prostate cancer? Something about testosterone in there? Or
What Dick noted was that for some men, there's a certain set of genes that's associated with the development of prostate cancer, and that it's driven in part by testosterone, and this could be the relationship with premature hair loss as well.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you very much for joining us, and we will see you again next week.
Look forward to it.
Okay. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Back in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of coverage of children born addicted to crack cocaine because their mothers were using during pregnancy. Now doctors have noticed a worrisome new trend. The number of babies addicted to prescription painkillers has more than doubled in the past few years. From the Southern Reporting Collaborative HealthyState.org, Dalia Cologne reports from member station WUSF.
2-year-old Devin Allen likes going to the fast food restaurant Chick-fil-A with his mom, Danielle Rose, and pretending his container of barbecue sauce is a car.
Is that what a car does?
Looking at Devin, you'd have no idea his mother was addicted to prescription painkillers when she discovered she was pregnant.
Being a drug addict, you'd think he'd be on birth control. Birth control costs money, and I had to pay for other things more important, like pills.
When Rose was 7 months pregnant, her sister urged her to get help. Rose finally found a methadone treatment clinic that would accept a pregnant woman. Because so many don't, neonatal intensive care units like this one at Tampa General Hospital are seeing more babies with problems. There are usually about 30 newborns here in this unit. Dr. Terry Ashmead says of those, at least 3 of them are withdrawing from prescription painkillers. 10 years ago, it was rare.
It was something that, you know, you kind of ran to the books and said, okay, what's the best treatment for that, and looked it up. Now, hospitals have guidelines and protocols, and they're using them frequently because this is something that you're seeing literally every day.
Nationwide, from 2003 to 2008, the number of babies diagnosed with newborn withdrawal syndrome more than doubled to almost 12,000, according to a survey by the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. In Florida, the trend is even more pronounced. In the last 5 years, the number of babies treated for withdrawal tripled, while the total number of births in Florida actually declined. The American Academy of Pediatrics is concerned about the trend. Vincent Smith is a Harvard neonatologist who advises the AAP.
It wasn't really tracked as well before. Now that people are becoming more aware of it, you're going to expect to see the numbers go up a little bit. What I suspect is that the numbers of kids who are going through withdrawal has gone up.
Devin was one of those kids. He was born on time and weighed 5 pounds, 5 ounces, a little less than average. Devin avoided the worst withdrawal symptoms because he was immediately put on methadone. But Tampa General's Terry Ashmead says other babies aren't so lucky.
They have feeding problems. They have vomiting. They have diarrhea. They have muscle stiffness and tremors. They cry inconsolably. And in the worst case scenarios, they have seizures.
When Rose took Devin home from the hospital, she had to give him the liquid medicine in a bottle for 6 months.
I put like a little bit of milk in it, just in the nipple, and then add the methadone so he couldn't really taste it. Doesn't taste like candy. It's gross. Really gross.
3 years later, Rose is training to be a counselor at the Christian-based treatment center that helped her. Doctors who study this field aren't sure what the future holds for babies born addicted to painkillers. Dozens declined to be interviewed for this story, and no one claims to be an expert. Harvard's Vincent Smith says the trend is just too new.
I just don't think that right now there's one centralized, globalized place that's going to be tracking this. I think over time it will, because it's becoming, you know, a bigger and bigger issue. I think in years past, it wasn't as big of an issue, but it's kind of hard to say because, you know, we don't really have much data.
That leaves an increasing number of kids like Devin in limbo and doctors worrying about the future. For NPR News, I'm Dalia Colon in Tampa.
For a long time, when you thought of American cheese, you thought of
Wisconsin.
But recently, Northern California has become a hub for cheesemaking, especially specialty cheeses, sometimes made with unpasteurized milk from small farms.
But now, high-profile recalls of cheese made with unpasteurized milk have put an unwelcome spotlight on the industry. Officials say they may tighten the rules on raw milk cheese, perhaps banning it altogether. KQED's Amy Standen reports.
Here in Point Reyes, 40 miles north of San Francisco, the Giacomini family has been raising dairy cows since 1959. Jill Giacomini Bash grew up here.
The milk here is really reflective of, you know, the climate, the grasses, the moderate temperature year-round.
Today, Giacomini Bash and her sisters run the Point Reyes Farmstead Cheese Company, best known for its $20 a pound original blue. Every step of the process takes place here on the farm.
Hey, honey. It's okay.
At no point is the milk for the blue cheese pasteurized. That means it's not superheated to kill bacteria. Farmstead's head cheesemaker, Kuba Hemmerling, says this is key to the cheese's flavor.
In a good way, I would call it the farmy. You know what I mean? You taste more of, you know, where the cows were and what was happening.
Selling raw or unpasteurized milk is illegal in most states. But under federal law, raw milk cheese is okay, as long as it's aged at least 60 days to kill harmful bacteria like E. coli, which can make its way from an animal's manure into milk. In recent months, two recalls involving E. coli in cheese have made headlines. First in November at Bravo Farms in California, then in December at Sally Jackson Cheese in Washington State. Because both cases involved raw milk cheese, the Food and Drug Administration has stepped up inspections on cheese facilities across the country. David Acheson is a former FDA associate commissioner.
When problems begin to emerge with a certain kind of food in a certain type of market, there's greater focus from the state, local, and federal regulators. They find the problems that have probably been lurking there all along.
Acheson says, for example, the FDA has long suspected that E. coli contamination can happen even when companies do follow the 60-day rule. He says scientific tests back this up.
E. coli was put into cheese and aged under lab conditions, and there was certainly evidence that to some extent it could survive the aging process.
FDA officials haven't said when the new rules would come out or what they'd look like, but Acheson says a key question will be whether any aging period is long enough to kill harmful bacteria, and if not,
then obviously the next step is making pasteurization an absolute requirement.
On average, about 40 people report getting sick from raw milk cheese a year nationwide. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Christine Hyatt is president of the American Cheese Society.
You know, when I look at the track record of cheese and the safety, it's pretty remarkable when you think about the number of people eating cheese every single day.
And many of these cheeses, far more, she says, than most people would realize, are made with unpasteurized milk.
Like Parmigiano Reggiano and Gruyere and Roquefort, they are all made with raw milk and have been for thousands of years.
Still, Hyatt says if the science supports a longer aging period, most of the cheesemakers her group represents would get behind that. Most raw milk cheese sold in the U.S. is aged for longer than 60 days anyway. But she thinks the agency should be careful not to discourage an industry that is only just beginning to take shape.
It would be a real shame to have a very small number of incidents lead to the demise of this really fascinating fledgling industry.
Especially, Hyatt says, because contamination can happen at any stage of the cheesemaking process, regardless of whether you use raw milk or pasteurized milk. Still, she says for cheesemakers across the country, the recent E. coli outbreaks have been a wake-up call. Back at Point Reyes Farmstead, sanitary precautions are a way of life. A recall, says Giacomini Bash, could jeopardize her family's business. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
Rockfort and Gruyere and Slippery Brie, all of these cheeses, they happen to me. Oh, please. Rough Pecorino and Moody Rams Hall, stop me before I just swallow it all. Oh, please. Somebody ring the cheese alarm. Oh, please, somebody ring the cheese alarm.
And that's all for your health, but if you just can't get enough of us, you can find our podcast much easier than before. Go to npr.org/healthpodcast. We had production assistance from Adam Cole.
And our health blogger is Scott Hensley. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.
Truckle of cheddar in a muslin rind. Would you give it all up?